the New Testament, Paul's letter to the Philippians, chapter 2, verses 19 to 30. Paul here turns to intimate details about himself and Timothy and Epaphroditus. And in doing so, he adopts a more hopeful frame of mind with regard to his own future than earlier. He is trusting in the Lord that at least he will have time to send to the Philippians young Timothy to find out how they are. For he has no one else, he says, like-minded enough to care for their welfare. Ah, and of course, that is a common complaint as far as the needs of distant saints are concerned, isn't it? Who will go for us? That was the cry of the Lord when Isaiah was arrested at his famous 6th chapter. And just as the Lord had his man in Isaiah at that critical time in Israel's history, so now, although the generality of men, he says, are so busy looking after their own affairs that they have no time or openness of mind and heart to hear the cry of others in need and respond to them, yet he has Timothy. No, the number of men ready to answer such a call may not be large, since people in general are too busy with their own affairs. But, you see, the Lord always has his man. This is one of the ways in which one has learned to trust the Lord concerning the loss of right-hand men and women in the work. Their loss by translation to other spheres of service, earthly or heavenly. The ready and often obvious provision of replacements for key workers is surely a sign that the Lord is with his people. Whereas we hear of such a lack and dearth of suitable men and women to man God's work in many places, that we wonder whether there is any spirit of prayer involved, such as our Lord advocated when he said, "Pray the Lord of the harvest to thrust laborers out into the harvest." Anyway, Paul has his man, and such a man as has served the Lord in serving Paul, like a son his father. Notice how Paul puts it, as I did during the reading. Timothy is not serving Paul directly, but he's serving the Lord with Paul. And this, of course, is of vital, crucial importance. For only devotion to Christ can be so absolutely pure that no complications can arise in their service. No difficulties, no strife, no tensions in congregational life where all are serving the Lord first. There are other commitments in life, of course, such as marriage and other alliances. But when Christ is the master of our service, we are not likely to let other selfish or prejudiced considerations come into our reckoning. someone hurts you. It may be, if you are serving the Lord in His church, someone hurts you. But you're not going to be so offended that you resign if you are really serving Christ. Why should Christ's work suffer because someone has hurt you? Leave the hurt with the Lord. He will sort it out if you can't. But where, you see, you have a whole cohort of men and women serving the Lord as a first priority, there you have harmony. From what I hear from the church all over the land and far beyond this land, in other continents, America, Africa, India, the Far East, I sometimes long that people would just come and sit with us for a little time and see how the Lord has taught us to love one another. I say, where a whole cohort of men and women serving the Lord as a first priority, there you have harmony and mutual cooperation and happy, fruitful service. So Paul promises the Philippians he will send Timothy shortly to inquire how they are doing. Meantime, he is waiting to see how things will turn out with regard to his own future, whether it is to be life and release from prison, as he hopes, or a martyr's death. However, Paul is assured in his own mind. The assurance seems to grow stronger as he writes or dictates that it is to be release and that he will be able to visit the Philippians again. Maybe he came to that positive conclusion while he was dictating this very letter. Indeed, this may be the way to clear one's mind. Here's a bit of advice to you. This may be the way to clear one's mind as to what the Lord is saying and planning, to set it all out, write it all out, and in the process begin to see more clearly what the Lord is saying. That's an idea. You might try it. Having determined this, he says, he has decided immediately to send back to them this other man, Epaphroditus, their own man, whom he calls a brother, a fellow worker, and a fellow soldier, whom the Philippians had earlier sent to minister to Paul in prison in Rome. You know, or you may not know, but if you've been here very long, you would know that I am interested in the threefold division of the people of God. It comes out constantly in prayers. There are the children of God, who are singing of them this night, born of the Spirit, truly born of the Spirit, but who may not yet have found their sphere of service. Infants cannot serve. Then there are those who have become God's servants, who serve Him in various capacities. And then there are those who have advanced to become His soldiers. That is to say, they have entered into such fellowship with the Lord and Master that they see the church's fight against God's enemy, Satan, and all his brood, and they conceive their service for Christ within the Christian church as being nothing short of warfare. It was a true insight of William Booth's, you know, that the Christian church is an army marching as to war. But alas, it is possible to gather all the accoutrements and the paraphernalia of war and yet turn it into something more suitable for the parade ground than the battlefield. ceremonial parades are for upstairs, after the battles are over and the war has been won. But you see, Epaphroditus is a fully-fledged soldier of Christ who had been sent by the Philippians to care for Paul in prison in Rome, which surely affords us some indication of the quality of the Christians being bred there in the church of Philippi. What happened to Epaphroditus, either en route for Rome or while he was there, we don't know. But to minister to Paul in prison, he had in some way risked his life and had been at the point of death. Whether this was due to a personal attack upon him, or to an illness which seized him, or whatever the cause, when the Philippians heard of it, they were deeply distressed. And when Epaphroditus heard of their distress, he was greatly distressed on their account. And of course, the whole circumstance would have deeply distressed Paul too, so that it must have been a huge relief to the apostle that Epaphroditus recovered. He says he saw it as an act of God's mercy to him, in not allowing him to be swallowed up with too much grief and care. Now, you cannot have failed to see from this passage that in a distressing and painful situation in which a dear Philippian saint came all the way from northern Greece to Rome to minister to the beloved disciple, there is a great burden of deep anxiety as to the man's welfare and survival, not only on Paul's part, but on the part of the Philippian saints at home, when they heard that Epaphroditus was so gravely ill. And you see, this simply reveals such a wealth of mutual care and concern, even by people separated by long distances, that the whole situation, the whole contretemps, is wrapped up in a huge bundle of tender love. That's what it is, tender love. What we read here simply provides further proof of the loving relationship which existed and flourished between Paul and his Philippian church. And it is bound to lead us to ask the question, why were they such a caring community as to send Epaphroditus all the way to Rome to minister to Paul, whatever that cost, that we know nothing about, but which certainly led to the endangering of this man's health and life? Now, on the surface of the New Testament records relative to Philippi and its church, it might appear, had you thought this, that Paul was only in Philippi for a very short time, and was, remember, summarily removed after the earthquake and the conversion of the jailer. But, you know, a more careful reading of the relevant verses, in Acts chapter 16 especially, will show that he may have been quite a long time in Philippi after meeting the women by the river, you remember, and the conversion of Lydia, and her invitation to the believers to meet in her house. Indeed, you remember the disturbance itself with the demon-possessed girl, which led to Paul's arrest. That took place, so the record says, over a period, her disturbance took place over a period of many days. Then further to how long Paul may have been with the Philippians at different times. There is a word of Paul being in Macedonia after his long sojourn in Ephesus. Acts 19:21 and Acts 21-3. And we subsequently read of him in Macedonia in 2 Corinthians 1:15 and 17, chapter 2, verse 13, and chapter 7, verse 5. And you can hardly imagine a visit by Paul to Macedonia that didn't include at least some time spent at Philippi, if not a staying visit. All of which seems to confirm that there grew up between Paul and the Philippians a rather rare quality of personal care and affection. Not that he would have loved the people of the other cities of Macedonia less, such as Thessalonica and Berea or anywhere else. But, haven't you noticed this? That some people let you love them more than others do. Some people honestly think that they are not lovable at all and assume that others will not love them. And so, whether it is due to some experience of rejection earlier in life or not, they bar your approach as if to say, stand back, I'm not worth bothering about. Now, with some people, that can be hypocritical and quite insincere. And that is really a left-handed invitation, and indeed a cry from the heart, to come nearer. But with some people, it truly stems from deep inferiority, bred by unhappy personal circumstances. Now, whether the Roman colony in Philippi made for an opener society than other cities in Macedonia would perhaps be for our expert on Roman history to say. But it is clear that the Philippians drew more love from Paul than other peoples did. And collaterally, he most satisfyingly drew more love from them than from other folk. And this is particularly seen in what Paul goes on to say to the Philippians about receiving and welcoming back Epaphroditus, especially after his life-threatening illness, whatever it was. After writing to them to say that they knew he was ill and nearly died, but that God had mercy on him and on Paul, sparing them both sorrow upon sorrow, Paul goes on to say, therefore I am all the more eager to send Epaphroditus back, so that when you see him again, you may be glad, and I may have less anxiety. Paul, less anxiety about what? Well, you would wonder. But this man's large heart takes on the most fabulous burdens of things and people of which he might legitimately have said, well, that's not any of my business, that's not my concern. But to a man burdened with the care of the churches, he cannot shrug off the cares he has had for souls, although time and space may be distant from them. If you have any idea what it costs an aging man, the pastoral work needing to be done that he cannot cope with, you will know the great backlog of service which ought to have been rendered, which, if not done by the pastor, may remain undone. But I was quoting Paul about his anxiety being relieved because Epaphroditus was going back home. So he says to them, "Welcome him in the Lord with great joy, and honor men like him, because he almost died for the work of Christ, risking his life to make up for the help." Notice, you could not yourselves give at such a distance. Now, this has been misunderstood. The last words in that paragraph have been misunderstood. There's no reproach there whatsoever on the part of the apostle that the Philippian saints did not do what Epaphras was able to do by his presence on the spot. Here, in what Paul says about them not being able to do for him, here is only a recognition that distance prevented them from doing for Paul what we are sure they would have been delighted to do had they been on the spot. But it so happened that however it was decided or determined, Epaphroditus was to go to Rome to comfort Paul and doubtless take him gifts. And so apparently, at some great risk to himself, which suggests danger to his person, he went. And it nearly cost him his life. But now, he seems to be safe and well and about to return home, having accomplished his task and forged even deeper bonds of love and care between the Philippians and the great apostle. So, you see, my dear friends, here was a happy church in Philippi, and a greatly relieved apostle sitting there in prison in Rome, waiting for what he had declared was his sure release. And so, you see, that's a happy way to end this wonderful chapter, and as we shall see, a happy way to commence the next, the third chapter, which Paul may have thought was his last. It wasn't. But that's surely why he began it, "Finally, my brothers." And what is this "finally"? It is simply the exhortation to rejoice in the Lord, as you can see if you turn the page, or spill over into the next chapter. For you see, we can become so taken up with people and their problems, their joys, and their sorrows, that quite inadvertently, we may take our eyes off the Lord. Service of Christ's church and the world must never be the first thing. Never. Many, many, many saints have lost themselves that way and turned to politics, and even many in our own Scotland in an earlier day in this century turned to atheism. Atheism through social service. How appalling and unnatural and wrong. Anyway, we're not going into this chapter tonight, but I cannot forbear to draw your attention to why Paul bids the Philippians at this juncture rejoice in the Lord. And he gives two reasons. First, it's no trouble to him. It's a pleasure to bid them rejoice in the Lord. And secondly, it is safe for them. It is safe for them. What does he mean? Ah, that takes me, if I may, to Nehemiah And that wonderful word which combines two things which are often in danger of being separated. What even Adolf Hitler called strength through joy. Do you remember his Volkswagen, the people's car? That was a sop which accompanied a promise that he would give them strength through joy, even while he raided their privacy and freedom and insanely tried to turn them into a Jew-hating and Jew-baiting nation. But do you remember the text I have in mind in Nehemiah? It is in Nehemiah chapter 8 and verse 10, where, you remember, Ezra stood to read the law to the people who had just returned to Jerusalem from Babylon. And Ezra is saying to them, this is no time for sorrow, even if you're thinking of the old temple and the Jerusalem that was, those of you who had returned. This is no time for sorrow, for all the people had been weeping, says the text, as they listened to the words of the law. Go, he said, and enjoy choice food and sweet drinks, not strong ones, but sweet ones, and send some to those who have nothing prepared. This day, he says, is sacred to the Lord. Do not grieve. And here it comes, the text. For the joy of the Lord is your strength. That's not quite the same as saying the joy of the Lord is your safety. It was safety that Paul was speaking about, but we may take them together, I think. That's how safe and secure and strong, stabilizing rejoicing is. It gives the necessary strength for us to do our work. So rejoice, because Paul is about to warn the Philippians in chapter 3 that there are enemies. See, yes, safety does come into this, you see, because he goes on to speak about the enemies that the Philippians will have. And so he says, in respect of your enemies, rejoice in the Lord. Isn't that interesting? Well, you remember what happened in Jehoshaphat's day, when the Moabites and the Ammonites and others, not the Edomites, came round the south side of the Dead Sea, the Salt Sea, to oppose Judah's armies. And Jehoshaphat decided that as they went out to battle, the choir from the temple would lead and sing their songs. And as the choir from the temple in Jerusalem sang, and the Jews can sing and shout, double forte, fortissimo, indeed. If you've ever been to a synagogue service, you would know that. You would need earplugs sometimes. They shout and sing so loudly that it terrified the armies. And what did they do? They turned against one another, and not only decimated one another, but wiped the whole lot out. And it was praise to God that did that. Our enemies are ever before us. So, because of that, this is perhaps a new idea to some. Rejoice. Rejoice in the Lord. however you rejoice, however sweetly, quietly, or sedately, or loudly, rejoice in the Lord, not in anyone or anything else. And Paul implies you will be safe. Rejoice, he says, because it's no trouble to me to tell you that. And for you, it will be safe. What a thought. So, let's close by rejoicing in the Lord in hymn number 135. 135. Rejoice, the Lord is King. And even as we sing, let us frighten the devil out of his wits.